/update.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You know, history can be pretty dull, especially if it's just taught as a sequence of dates and monarchs and treaties. Pencils now, quiz at the end of the program. 1820, George IV, the Missouri Compromise, and the final act of the Vienna Congress. You see what I mean? So when someone offers a narrative version of history, a chance to track time through stories, it's a tempting alternative. Well, too tempting, says the Irish historian Roy Foster. He says this approach leads to the creation of myths, cultural and political, that obfuscate rather than elucidate the past. Foster says Irish history is especially prone to this weakness and has become redesigned as a narrative of evasion, of maneuvered and marketable memory. It's high time, says Foster, that the tales of the famine, political oppression, and Republican struggle get dragged out and given a good historical interrogation. So, Connection listeners, where is the truth in history? Does it have to be objective to be true, or can stories and the myths find their place without replacing what really happened? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, Roy Foster. He's a professor of history at Oxford. His book on Irish history is called The Irish Story, Telling Tales and Making It Up in Ireland. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Roy, what's wrong with myths? I mean, where would America be without Mark Twain and Cowboys and Indians, Gone with the Wind? Those are part of this country's history.
Absolutely, though you instance Mark Twain and Gone with the Wind, which of course are fiction, not history. Cowboys and Indians is, if you like, debased history. I think any country creating itself needs myths. I mean, Ireland clearly needed to construct itself when it became independent in the 1920s and construct a national memory, which it did in a very, I think, brilliant and sophisticated way, and that's what this book is partly about. But what interests me is that now at this point, when I suppose Ireland is becoming postmodern like everywhere else, the narratives have solidified, in a sense, into a pop history. And I think that the idea of there not having been an absolute apostolic succession of inevitabilist progress, I think that should be looked at. I think alternative endings that might have happened should be looked at. And I think the way the myths were constructed should be looked at. And by the way, I mean, I think it's also true that obviously myths of other countries that have constructed themselves should be looked at, notably the British Empire, which Linda Colley is currently deconstructing in her new book, Captives, which looks at the stories of empire and how they calcify into a myth.
The Irish Story is the name of your book. So what's the Irish story that you want people to focus on if they're too distracted by the narratives and the autobiographies as history?
The Irish story uses very often the experience of the individual to map it against the history of the nation. You know, Irish heroes become carriers in themselves of the national story. The individual experience is seen as a replication of the national experience, and usually it's an experience of heroism, martyrdom, imprisonment, oppression, endurance, and eventually deliverance. It's also mapped against the Christian story very, very clearly and, in fact, explicitly in famous canonical history books like The Story of Ireland, which is the subject of one of the chapters in this book. So the Irish story, in a sense, borrows other narrative frameworks to tell the story of the nation. And in so doing, I think it closes off a great deal of other stories, of subordinate stories, which are blanked out. It also assumes that there's one inevitable outcome at the end, as with any determinist story, as with the Marxist story. But one thing I think that we've learned recently, and one of the kind of payoffs among the many disadvantages of postmodernist literary criticism and so forth, is the idea of competing stories and the notion that you can't privilege one particular narrative at the expense of other possible narratives.
I have in front of me a copy of McCourt's Angela's Ashes. It's something that you point to in your story. And I'll just read a little part of it here. I'll be brief. Dad doesn't care about my tooth or anything. He says I'm going to confession and drags me over to the Redemptorist Church because it's Saturday and confessions go on all day. He tells me I'm a bad boy. He's ashamed of me that I went to the pictures instead of learning Ireland's national dances, the jig, the reel, the dances that men and women fought and died for down those sad centuries. Now, what's wrong with Frank McCourt if he wants to take from his piece of Ireland, write a story about it? Because you use it as an example of the flaw in the Irish story.
I do. I use it as a, well, actually it's in a chapter that deals with a number of best-selling childhood memoirs of the last 10 years. I mean, it's not only, I'm not...
Jerry Adams among them, Will.
Jerry Adams among them. I'm not by any means isolating Frank McCourt, who's made a great success, and I'm always very happy to see anyone have a great success with the book. The book itself seems to me oddly fuzzy and strange. And in fact, the father who turns up there, I can never quite get what role he's playing. The attitude of the son towards him is never quite consistent, as the attitude towards many things in the book aren't consistent, because I think he's attempting to have it all sorts of ways at once. He begins the book by laughing at the cliche of the miserable Irish Catholic childhood. And you think, oh good, he's going to subvert this in some way. Then the book turns into the ur-cliché of the miserable Catholic childhood, with deliverance, like the story of Ireland always has, deliverance and rescue at the end into the promised land of the United States. And along the way, I think a lot of issues are fudged. Along the way, there's a certain number of anomalies, and I'm by no means the only person to point these out. And along the way, there are narrative tricks which seem to me to be borrowed from a whole range of previous memoirs of Irish childhood. And, you know, McCourt was a legendarily good teacher of literature. And I think, in a sense, his own memoir, as is inevitably the case, absorbs a great deal of his reading. Its fictionalization of his own story seemed to me to take over in a very interesting way. But the other thing that interested me was the huge, huge success it had, this multi-million sales profile, and why it hit a nerve at this particular moment of, as it was then, very late 20th century time.
But it's a story. It's not history. Why does its success or its ability to penetrate matter in our understanding of Irish history?
It's a story, but he says a story in which every fact is true. And I think that that's problematic for a start. I think the reaction of the Irish market to this book was also very interesting, that there was fury in certain sectors, especially of Limerick, the town he describes.
But I can go on Angela's Ashes tours in Limerick now.
Yes,
can
well,
I
that's
not?
The point. There was fury at the squalor and the poverty and all the rest of it he described in some quarters, and people went on television to say, no, it was never like that. But in other quarters, people said, great, let's make something of this. And this whole development of what I call misery tourism arrived, where, as you say, you can take tours of the probable places where events in this book took place, though again there are difficulties there. You can, you know, go to pubs called Angela's Ashes. You can do all sorts of things, but people make pilgrimages. Some woman was interviewed and said she was doing it to find strength to stay with her alcoholic husband, which makes no sense at all, since I think one of the good things about both McCourt's books is a very strong demonstration of the Irish propensity to take solace in alcohol.
So is this about America's consumption of the story, or is it about the Irish story?
It's about Americans' consumption of the way that an Irish narrative can be deployed to tell you what you want to hear. It's also about rich, successful, Europeanized, postmodern Ireland's reaction to hearing about the miseries of 50 or 60 years before. In both cases, the appetite seems boundless.
Let's go back to the potato famine. It's something that you write about that's perhaps more a part of history rather than myth in our minds, but you say this has been turned, the understanding that it was the potato famine that sent so many of the residents of Boston and the Eastern Seaboard in the United States fleeing the island.
Well, that's a matter of fact. You know, there's There's no way that can be gainsaid. Although, again, it should be remembered that 1.5 million had left
before.
In the 20 years before the famine.
Right.
No, the facts of the famine, though actually, as many economic historians have pointed out, there's still an awful lot to be established about them, they're there. The reaction to the famine and the way it is built into the Irish story is more problematic. What's happened in the last few years when there was this great binge of commemoration of the 150th anniversary of it, what happened there was that the fashionable, initially French, notion of memory rather than history became employed, and the language of psychoanalysis became used. And the whole idea that the Irish people had suffered a collective trauma and a suppressed memory, which didn't make sense at all, because actually if you go anywhere in rural Ireland, traditions of famine times are very strong. This memory is not suppressed. You know, it's there. And Cormac O'Grother, who has written much of the best books about the famine, continually reiterates this, that the idea of suppression of memory and the fact that you have to kind of excavate it to get behind the trauma, it's a trope borrowed from psychoanalysis, which just doesn't refer to or isn't relevant to the way we remember the famine. But the industry of commemorationism and the feel-good psychobabbling approach to commemorationism borrowed, I think, in a rather tasteless way from Holocaust studies in order to project onto the famine, which is a terrible and a catastrophic event in Irish history 150 years ago, which did, as you rightly say, construct a great deal of how the great achievement of Irish America was built.
It's also used as a key point of the Irish pointing to the oppression of the English at that time, and you're saying that even that's not quite accurate when you look at the details of the famine?
Oppression in an emotive way can then elide into accusations of genocide, which did, and those accusations have been made in very recent times by people who have, I think, a much stronger interest in political agendas than in historical discovery. Again, as any historian of the famine, Robert Scally, Cormac O'Grother, Timothy Ginnane, anyone will say, the administration of the famine was catastrophically inefficient and catastrophically hidebound by contemporary economic dogma, which was interestingly dropped about 20, 30 years later when there was another threatened famine in 1879, and the British government threw every resource it had at it, knowing how disastrous the previous event had been and what the terrible results were and what political use had been made of it. But this isn't genocide. This is, as I say, a government hidebound by economic dogma, and we've seen governments in our own day hidebound by economic dogma. This is also about the apathy of the haves faced with the horrors of the have-nots in a different area. Certainly the famine had taken place on the larger of the two islands that were then linked into the Union of Great Britain and Ireland. I think more interventionist measures would have been taken. But even within Ireland, the variations of famine experience were enormous. And that also means that it's a more complex matter than thought.
Roy Foster is my guest. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about the story of Ireland, the Irish story, and the way that history can be used or abused. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Mathworks.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Here's a little clip from a scene, the movie The Commitments, where the young man Jimmy Rabbit's trying to convince his would-be band members to sound a little bit more like James Brown.
That's what you've got to measure up to, lads.
Do you not think, maybe we're a little white for that kind of thing.
Do you not get it, lads? The Irish are the blacks of Europe, and Dubliners are the blacks of Ireland, and the Northside Dubliners are the blacks of Dublin. So say it once, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud.
My guest is Roy Foster, Professor of History at Oxford, author of The Irish Story, Telling Tales and Making It Up in Ireland. Like they were making it up in the commitments?
Well, I'm a great Roddy Doyle fan, let me instantly say that, and a great James Brown fan if it comes to that. But yeah, I mean, that's a very clever, and Doyle is an immensely sophisticated, clever writer. It's a very clever use of a kind of modern myth, and certainly by the time of the Celtic Tiger, the Irish are very far from the blacks of Europe. There are many other candidates jostling for that position at the moment. But it's a trope, again, that's used in the marketing of Irishness and in the making Irishness fashionable.
The mope syndrome?
The mope syndrome.
Most depressed people ever.
But it can be used in other ways. I mean, fashionable blackness, again, can be used for fashionable Irishness. Gerry Adams continually trying to shift the argumentative territory onto a ground where the IRA looks exactly like the ANC and therefore he will look exactly like Nelson Mandela. You know, there are many, many ways in which this is very cleverly manipulated.
Why do you say, though, that this is something which is in some way particular to Ireland? I was thinking of other examples of places that I've been and things that I've seen where the myths and the history are used to justify behavior. And Bosnia comes to mind as an example where the different sides lean very heavily on their myths to say who they are today. So in what way do the Irish stand apart from that?
They don't at all. I mean, it's just that those countries are, I guess, at the stage that Ireland may have been at in the early 1920s when mm-hmm. it was constructing its myth. I was fascinated, in fact, to see a program about Slovakia creating its national anthem and creating its new traditions. That great phrase, the invention of tradition, which Erik Hobsbawm pioneered, is very applicable to what's going on in new countries in Eastern Europe now. Though that's to call them new countries, of course, to beg a number of historic questions. And it was certainly happening in my country in the 1920s. What's interesting now, I think, is that a kind of space has happened after which we can think about it more analytically than we used to.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Roy Foster is my guest. We're going to Orleans, Indiana. Nick is on the line. Hello, Nick.
Hey, it's good morning. Good topic. I really appreciate, Dr. Foster's explosion of a lot of this myth. I'm Scots-Irish myself, and I remember growing up hearing the history that we could trace our ancestry back to Robert Bruce in Scotland. And the reality is so much different when you start looking at people like William Wallace back in Scotland here, and, you know, the movie Braveheart. There was all this nationalism of, well, isn't it wonderful? But when you look at the reality, it wasn't there. The same with the potato famine. How many people from Scotland were forced to leave the Crofters and all of the people there that were forced to emigrate to this country in the 1700s? And again, with the potato famine, it wasn't just isolated to Ireland. It was strictly, the economics of the issue.
Let me ask you about Braveheart, though, because it's a point that that Roy makes as well, and that is that even though it's a movie, it enters our brain as part of history. Do you think that means that we need to stay away from mythologizing people like that, putting them in films?
No, I just think we should know what is myth and what is true history. I people came away from the movie. We were over in Scotland here about 5-6 years ago, and we'd gone over in the salesmanship of promoting William Wallace and Robert Bruce was unbelievable. I mean, there were posters everywhere and, you know, this is wonderful and we've got Scottish nationalism. And I have no problem with that, but I think, you know, your point is that there is what really happened and here is the myth.
What Nick says is absolutely right about the marketing of Braveheart, and it had a very definite political agenda at the time, which everyone spotted. People like Tom Nairn have written very wittily and brilliantly about this. It also piggybacked onto this notion of Celticism, which has become very fashionable in a kind of New Age feel-good way. There's all these spiritual primers about Celticism. But, historians are very doubtful whether Celticism ever existed. Who were the Celts? And I remember Mel Gibson in one interview saying he'd worked very hard to get the right Celtic accent for the part of Braveheart. I mean, what's a Celtic accent? I'd love to know. Is it somewhere, you know, midway between the coasts of Ireland and Scotland? It is a mythic invention. I would just take Nick up on one thing he said, which is that, you know, OK, the Irish had the potato famine, but lots of others. It was, there is a difference of scale there. I think that the catastrophic dimensions of the famine and the numbers of people who both died of famine fever and emigrated were out of... I mean, there were OK famines in Belgium and Scotland, indeed, small potato famines this time, but nothing like this. Though he's right that the story of Scots emigration and, in a sense, Scots oppression has been much less marketed and much less told than that of the Irish.
Nick, thanks a lot for your call. You made a reference earlier in the program, Roy, to the story of Ireland. And there were two, in fact. There was Sullivan's story of Ireland, followed, what, some 20 years later by Standish O'Grady's story of Ireland.
Mm. There's many books with that title. It lends itself.
But what struck me was that they were, in many ways, back at the end of the 19th century, having exactly the same argument that you're having with the mythic historians of Ireland today.
Oh, God, I hope not. That's very depressing. No, I don't.
But aren't
I don't
they? I mean, if Sullivan was pushing a nationalist sense of the country and I mean, O'Grady was politically incorrect. People accuse you of being politically incorrect by being... Well, I'm sorry. I've just heard that, by the by.
I'd hate to think that we hadn't moved on from the sort of Kulturkampf that was very clearly defined around the turn of the century in Ireland. On the other hand, I think you might, though I flinched at it, you might have something. Because what's interesting about cultural discussions in Ireland around the time that O'Grady wrote that book, which I think 1894, 95, over the next sort of 10 years or so, there is an amazing moment, I think, in Irish cultural history. In writing my first volume on Yeats, I was very struck by this, where, okay, on the one hand, there is this kind of monolith of nationalist ideology and rhetoric confronting a monolith of unionist ideology and rhetoric. At the same time, the middle ground's been opened up. There's a great proliferation of small magazines, a great proliferation of cross-party groups. There's a great expansion, it's the first real expansion of a kind of socialist and labour political consciousness in Ireland, which looks at the issue rather differently from in the old Britain versus, you know, Hibernia versus Britannia way. And in some ways, 100 years later, in the 1990s to the present moment, I think there is a parallel moment where you have, okay, two monoliths confronting each other, okay, now restricted to the northeastern six counties, but at the same time, you do have a new kind of cultural pluralism and a new kind of readiness to accept that the other person's story, though you don't like it, might be a story you have to look at and listen to and think about.
1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation to Arlington, Massachusetts. Laurie's joining us. Hi, Laurie.
Hello. I just had a comment. I think one of the reasons maybe that the mythical history of Ireland is so popular in America and in Ireland to a certain extent is it stops Irish history at the Civil War at the latest, you know, the 1920s, and makes Irish history all about the distant past. So you can rail as much as you like and expose as many injustices as you like, but it's all safely distant. It doesn't require any present-day action. It's just like in the U.S. when we want to make a TV show that's about an unjust society in America. We always set it in the 60s so that it doesn't imply that that sort of thing's going on now. And there's just a lack of interest or courage to do a lot of, like, the writing kind of that John McGarn does, where you take, you know, what was for him at least the 60s, present-day Ireland, and say, well, you know, there are things going on now.
Oh, God, I could talk about this all day. You're absolutely right, Laurie. There is a closure. I grew up with this closure because when I learned history at school in the 1950s and early 60s, the history syllabus has stopped in 1916 with the Rising, which actually, you know, was a failure. It's in the subsequent few years that the revolution got going, but that was the last point at which everyone agreed on the story, so it stopped there. Great. The fact that, you know, I lived in a country where the two political parties were defined by the fact that they'd been on different sides in a civil war, you know, but don't talk about the war. It's not like that at all now, I have to say. The modern Irish history syllabuses go up very near the present. They're very frank and, I think, brilliantly inventive and impartial about what happened in our contested history over the last three quarters of a century. But you're right about the idea of stopping it somewhere. I wince slightly when you say the 1960s, since that's when I like to think that I began my becoming a historian, and I don't ever think of it as that long ago. But the notion of it, of a cordon sanitaire being imposed at a moment in time that you can put everything back to there and evaluate it then and not have a continuum up to the present is very, very important and very much part of the way we have, in the past at least, sectioned off our history.
But it's a part of that narrative invasion of history in that we don't actually want to deal with that part of the story until we know how it comes out, until it ends.
Yeah, the other thing implicit in Laurie's question was the idea of an agreed ending. And that, of course, is very central to what I've written about in the first chapter of this book, which is called The Story of Ireland, which is the idea that there is an ending, and we've all agreed about it. And what I do is, in fact, I map the notions of Irish history as traditionally imbibed against the functions of the folk tale as invented by structuralist critics back in the 1930s. You know, every folk tale goes through only about 7 or 8 given variations, and there's always this incident and that incident, and it always ends with this form of deliverance. And I look at various mini stories within the whole Irish story and map them against this, and they do conform to Vladimir Propp's theory of a folk tale with amazing exactitude.
I think you can't underestimate the role of the U.S. in this too, because you know, I think Angela's Ashes is such a huge hit over here. We love to get Irish literature that, you know, fulfills our, you know, images of our own ancestors, and you don't have a big audience in the United States for, you know, literature about contemporary Ireland. We want that, you know, distant vision where everything ends with coming to America and turning into us.
Do you think so? Because, I mean, Roddy Doyle was mentioned, and does he sell over here? I mean, because books like The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, which I think is one of the most disturbing and striking Irish novels of the last 20
perhaps
years.
Perhaps better in Newfoundland than in Boston.
Yeah, well, possibly. But certainly Irish fiction is going through a kind of golden age at the moment, and people like Conn Tobin, John Banville, Anne Enright, Glenn Patterson, Robert McLean Wilson, you know, I don't want to be invidious because I've no doubt left out many, which could go on, but these are people who are structuring or constructing contemporary Ireland into very interesting and dramatically effective and powerful fictional narratives. We used to do the short story, now we do the novel.
Laurie, thanks for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK to Durham, North Carolina. David's joining us. Hi, David.
Yes, hello. Switching genres once again, I suppose. I realize it's not really storytelling, much less memoir, but I was wondering if Dr. Foster had any thoughts about the role of Irish poetry in this myth-making. I mean, I'm thinking specifically, I guess, about the sort of nostalgia that suffuses the work of Seamus Heaney and some others, but I was really thinking specifically of Heaney.
That's a mischievous question. In fact, Conn Tobin, whose novel I've just mentioned, very mischievously refers to Heaney and the other early Field Day writers as the pre-electric men. He thinks that, you know, they kind of construct an Ireland before the electricity pylons arrived and where everyone lived in a kind of prelapsarian rural paradise. I think that's incredibly unfair, though it's very funny.
Well,
look at Heaney's Station Island, which to me is probably his masterwork so far. And okay, it's referring to all sorts of imbibed narratives of Irish history, but it's mapping them against contemporary violence in a very, very powerful way, I think.
I guess mentally, I always oppose the kind of shot to fame of somebody like Heaney with the relative obscurity of a writer like Thomas Kinsella, who's a much more urban, yet mythological in his own way, sort of writer.
Well, Kinsella, who I think is a magnificent poet, is less celebrated, but and also writes about contemporary Ireland and violence and so forth, but I think he just... Well, I do think Heaney is a fantastically wonderful poet, and Kinsella is not quite up there. I think there's a simple question of poetic voice and poetic effect, which isn't just something you can kind of market. And Heaney has it, and he's head and shoulders, well, certainly head above most of the others. Derek Mahon, though, is somebody who I think, like Kinsella, may not get his full due, but who certainly doesn't take refuge in a kind of construction of imagined nostalgic Ireland, and Paul Muldoon absolutely doesn't. I think that what the great efflorescence of Irish poetry has done is to make people read about Ireland in, as poets are supposed to do, in new ways, and to take new angles on things, but also, and I think of the work of Michael Longley here, to set up echoes back into Irish historical ways of thinking, which poets can do very economically and very plangently, Yeats above all.
David, thanks for your call. Mr. Yeats, September 1913. What need you being come to sense but fumble in a greasy till and add the halfpence to the pence and prayer to shivering prayer until you have dried the marrow from the bone? For men were born to pray and save. Romantic Ireland's dead and gone. It's with O'Leary in the grave. Very much part of the politics and the myth-making of the time, in and out.
Yeah, but he had to unsay all that after 1916, and he effectively did in a number of very carefully nuanced poems about nationalism. John Montagu, another perhaps underrated poet, took that trope up after sexual liberation hit Ireland in the 60s, and I think his refrain was, "Romantic Ireland's dead and gone, a myth of O'Connor and O'Fuillon," which was his way of seeing it.
I should point out to our listeners that Roy Foster is also the current biographer of William Butler Yeats. His first volume is out. It's The Apprentice Mage. The second one has just been completed and delivered to the publisher.
It's going through copy editing now, and it'll be out about this time next year.
The second of three?
No, the second of two.
The second? Oh, this is the last.
No, this gets them dead.
Oh, I thought it was three. So you're finished.
Yep.
We'll talk a little bit more about Yeats when we come back. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. The way that the writers, the historians, the filmmakers, and the poets create the myths that become part of the history, how that works and doesn't particularly work well. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. And neighborly love.
Because of our traditions, everyone here knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, the Irish historian Roy Foster. His latest book, The Irish Story, Telling Tales and Making It Up in Ireland. Well, perhaps not his latest book. His latest one is the completion of the Yeats biography called The Arch Poet, the first volume, The Apprentice Mage. We were talking about Yeats, just before we went to the break, Roy. I pulled a little something out of Yeats' Reveries Over Childhood and Youth, in which he's talking once again about John O'Leary, the Irish nationalist, and he says, "O'Leary had once said to me, 'Neither Ireland nor England knows the good from the bad in any art, but Ireland, unlike England, does not hate the good when it's pointed out to her.'" This is Yeats speaking. "I began to plot and scheme how one might seal with the right image the soft wax before it began to harden. I had noticed that Irish Catholics, among whom had been born so many political martyrs, had not the good taste, the household courtesy and decency of the Protestant Ireland I had known. Yet Protestant Ireland seemed to think of nothing but getting on in the world. I thought we might bring the two halves together if we had a national literature that made Ireland beautiful in the memory and yet had been freed from provincialism by an exacting criticism." He's very much there where you are now.
It's a wonderful piece of dangerous prose, that. And, of course, he's saying things, you know, especially in that age, especially if you were a liberal Protestant, you were not supposed to make generalizations about Catholics. It's very bad manners what he's doing. But he's doing it in such fantastic prose and ending with such an interesting idea that he almost gets away with it. Yeah, that was the agenda he set himself. And that was how he saw life when when Irish politics and Irish independence were in a fluid state, as he saw it, wax. Actually, an image he stole from Stanish O'Grady's Story of Ireland, where he uses the image of Ireland.
You used
as wax.
It a little earlier in the program,
yeah.
too. You were talking about
well, it's hard to get away from. But then Yeats lives through Irish independence, and he also anticipates. In fact, one of the key reflections of Yeats that started me thinking in this kind of way was something he said in 1926. Can I read it quickly?
Yeah, please.
He just gave this in a newspaper interview after the great row about Sean O'Casey's play, The Plough and the Stars, and someone stood up and said to Yeats, how about all this? Why do we find it so difficult to see plays criticising ourselves? And Yeats replied, as the Irish Times recorded, when a nation is immature, it's exceedingly vain and doesn't believe in itself. And so long as it doesn't believe in itself, it wants other people to think well of it in order that it might get a little reflected confidence. With success comes pride, and with pride comes indifference as to whether people are shown in a good or bad light on the stage. As a nation comes to intellectual maturity, it realizes that the only thing that does it any credit is its intellect. And I thought that was very interesting, that distinction between vanity and pride. And again, you think forward, and I hope that what's happening in new, prosperous, independent, Europeanized Ireland is a sense of pride taking over from the
vanity.
Insecurities of vanity.
But you're doing, in many ways, the same thing that Yeats is doing. You're asking questions that some people don't want to have asked, and you are opening yourself to criticism that you're a West Brit and an Anglo-Irish, just like Yeats did. Don't look startled at me, Mr. Foster.
Well, Anglo-Irish, God, I wish. I'm in a way, you know, Anglo-Irish are people with big houses and horses and all that. I come from the, I suppose, underestimated couche sociale of the middle-class Irish Protestant, you know, school teachers, 30-acre farmers kind of thing, who have actually been written out. It's very interesting you say that Anglo-Irish thing, because there's this notion that all Irish Protestants outside the north of Ireland are kind of people with decaying Georgian houses that Jennifer Johnston and William Trevor write about. I assure you, they're not. So let's get that clear. This is why I
it's a small cottage in Waterford that the thatch needs repairing. Shall we go with that?
There isn't one. There's nothing. No, I wouldn't for a moment say that my enterprise is at all like Yeats's. I wouldn't put myself up there at all. I would also want to say very quickly that I'm one of a generation. You know, when your earlier caller, Laurie, talked about the 1960s as being this dim, distant past. In the 1960s, I was one of a whole generation of Irish historians who were starting to look at the narratives and to try and think about them again. And I could instant names like David Fitzpatrick, Tom Dunn, Mary Daly, Cormac O'Groda, whom I've mentioned. There are many of us. And it's a movement. I don't like the R word. You use the revisionist word. And
you
some
call
of
it
those,
a pejorative...
It's been used pejoratively now by polemicists, and some of the people I mentioned would not describe themselves as revisionists, but they've certainly engaged in revising received notions of Irish history and made themselves often unpopular as well.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Newton, Massachusetts now. Brian's joining us. Hello, Brian.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good to be with you. Really interesting discussion today. Just wondering if there isn't a tendency towards too much revisionism, if it isn't becoming a thing in itself to create almost a counterpoint to some of the literature that has arisen throughout this century, including Angela's Ashes. Are there grains of truth in Angela's Ashes for an immigrant population nostalgic for home that have a legitimacy that are now being knocked regularly in this rush towards revisionism, almost for revisionist's sake? Is that something that we should avoid?
Yeah, I don't think there's a rush towards revisionism for revisionism's sake. The generation after me of historians are, in fact, like to call themselves post-revisionists and are often take me and my generation very critically to task. And in some ways, some of the older Story of Ireland verities are being resurrected by younger historians who may actually feel rather as you do. On the Angela's Ashes point, Brian, there certainly are kernels of truth there, and there are very effective things in it about poverty and attitudes towards illegitimacy and snobberies at various levels in Irish society from which the hero escapes to America.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is, in many ways, a valuable story is being told. I just found it anomalous in many ways in the way it was told. And I'm not trying to knock this book specifically. I'm trying to understand why it turned into a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And again, a follow-up argument to that would be for people like me who grew up in the 60s and 70s, so a fairly younger generation than that represented in the book, that there were indeed kernels of truth. And you know, I grew up in West Cork at a fairly dismal time, mm-hmm. fairly drab West Cork town, where the poverty levels described by McCourt and Angela's Ashes didn't exist. But in some housing rows and in some terrible examples of poverty and domestic abuse, etc., that there was some resonance, even with me, in Angela's Ashes.
Mm.
And sometimes it's popular to knock this thing, particularly now I'm kind of alarmed, because often there is a tendency amongst Irish-born to knock Irish-American nostalgia, and I think it's a dangerous thing. And there's a headlong rush almost now, it seems, to take Angela's Ashes as the rallying cry of that movement. And I would hesitate to just move straight into that realm without just asking the questions of what in this literature is good, what is bad, the same as what is good and what is bad coming out of current literature. You know, the plays of McDonagh and the new playwrights who are showing Ireland in a very different light.
Right.
Point taken. The plays of McDonagh I find problematic, I must say, in that I think they're another kind of mythic construction. The Irish theatrical renaissance deserves a programme to itself, but the particular McDonagh plays, which are written by someone who grew up in England of Irish background, by the way, and I think that's important, I think are not a particularly enlightening guide. I'd direct people more to Sebastian Barry or possibly Martina Carr or some other of the new playwrights. But I take your point about the grains in Angela's Ashes and also the attitude of people in Ireland towards Irish America, which is often as ignorant as the attitude of Irish Americans towards Ireland can be.
1-800-423-8255. Brian, thanks for your call to Charlotte, Vermont, and Frank's joining us. Frank?
Yes, hi. Thanks for pronouncing it correctly. We're strange in Vermont, too. I have, you know, just sort of a questions/comments, and it sounds like an interesting book, and I'll definitely read it, because the reason being that I plan on moving to Ireland. It's kind of the reverse of the great myth of coming to the States.
Are you a descendant of Irish immigrants?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
I have Irish citizenship through my grandfather, and I guess what I'm trying to find out as I read things and go on is I do want to see myths exploded. And the other thing is, somebody with my issues, you know, moving back to the country, what sort of, you know, great big surprises can I expect to see? And also, I'm wondering just how people like me are being regarded generally around the country. That's really it. There's an answer, and I'll probably end up elaborating on the answer, but
that's
what I'm thinking about. You know?
And what he's talking about is also, I'll get you to speak specifically to Frank's point, but the economic success that is a part of Ireland today.
Yeah, well, now this phenomenon of reverse emigration is fascinating. People are coming back, and the part of Ireland I go to in the summers and at Christmas in County Kerry, more and more people are returning and have been for some time. The Celtic Tiger is beginning to look slightly mangy at the moment, it has to be said. The economy isn't looking as brilliant as it was. And I got an Irish Times yesterday, in fact, in Chicago, and I saw that there are gloomy outlooks and cuts. And
don't sell the house, Frank.
The palmy days are over. But it's still. I have to say, Irish economic growth rates are way above the EU average. Inflation is okay. It's perhaps heading towards 5%, which is not great. But salaries are up a great deal. The standard of living compared to what I remember, and the previous questioner grew up in West Cork, I mean, I remember from my youth in the 50s and early 60s in Waterford how poor certain areas could be, but the prosperity is enormous. The returned Yank, as they used to be called, are, I think he'll be very generally welcomed. And one of the interesting things, of course, that's happening too is immigration is not only coming from Americans or people of Irish American stock returning to live in houses. It's coming from refugees from Eastern Europe. And this has brought with it the outburst of, in certain areas, some pretty unpleasant and one would have to say sub-racist attitudes. A great deal of insecurity.
Making the story yet again a little bit more complex.
Much more complex. But also, I have to say that in many areas, and again, I think of the village in Kerry that we go to, the incursors, or as they might be seen, are joining a community. Their kids are at the local schools. They're, you know, working in local shops and small industries. And these interestingly, initially unpronounceable names are being rounded into Irish forms. And you can see it happening. It's a fascinating development. What has happened over... I left Ireland to go and live in England in 1974, though I've always gone back endlessly, several times a year. But the change over that 30 years has been astonishing. And if Frank knew Ireland first 30 years ago, he would find it a transformed country now.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I was struck by one chapter in your new book about 1798 and the way that that event, when a bunch of nationalist rebels were rounded up and shot at a beech tree in County Wicklow. Have I got that part right?
Well, that's part of a much wider uprising.
Yes, but that one specific event is one that you use to track this strange way that these things are memorialized.
It seemed to me emblematic of Irish memory. I went to see an old man who was then about 90 in County Wicklow in the early 1970s, who lived on an estate. He had been an Irish revolutionary himself 70 years before, and I was interviewing him. And he mentioned that there was a beech tree on the estate that his father had wanted to get cut down. This would be the late 19th century, and none of the men on the place would cut it. They said it was unlucky. And finally he got in people from somewhere else, and when they got the saws through, the saws stopped and jarred and went blunt because the beech tree was peppered with lead, and it was where rebels had been shot against in 1798. And it seemed to me a very interesting case of the memory being perhaps deferred slightly. The tree was seen as unlucky, or perhaps the workers on the estate knew perfectly well what had happened, but they weren't going to be tactless enough to say so. And it was also a sense of how the horrors of that particularly awful and bloody summer of 1798, where awful things were done.
I need to move along quickly. In 1898, that event is remembered for what it was, but in 1998, something quite different.
It was commemorated in 1898 and built into the nationalist ideology and rhetoric of the time. And then in 1998, it's built into a kind of new Euro-friendly rhetoric. The government takes it over. They say this was a completely non-sectarian feel-good rebellion that somehow went slightly wrong. What the rebels wanted, because they were very keen on revolutionary France, was to have a kind of Euro-Ireland before its time. Astonishing things were said, and I think ought to be looked at rather carefully.
Which you do, and it's great to read, and nice to have you in the studio.
Very nice to be here, Dick. Thank you.
Roy Foster, author of The Irish Story, Telling Tales and Making It Up in Ireland, also biographer of William Butler Yeats. First volume, The Apprentice Mage. Second one, just gone to the publisher, The Arch Poet. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is Here and Now.